Welcome back, Fiends to Handle. Whiscare presented by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Our show discusses horror movies and the phobias they emphasize. Throughout April, we've been taking a closer look at pharsophobia and the fear of pranks in horror. Before I introduce tonight's film and my co-host, just a few general reminders for you guys. You can stay connected with us over on X at Handle Whiscare. Be sure to join us for our Twisted Tuesday and Thursday watch parties, which we stream over at kick.com/really drunk, and that's every Tuesday and Thursday at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, with the pretty occasional pre-stream over in our Discord as well. Now, with that being said, as always, I am joined by my co-host, Grindhouse Zombie. And, you know, Zombie, we've taken a couple of stops at summer camp lately. You know, I know recently you had brought to my attention Camp Pleasant Lake, which was one of my recent watches. That was the quote, handlewithscare.com flick. And, you know, I have to say, like, I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. I think when you compare that movie to, I guess, like, the most, like, the common thread there would be to, like, something like Hellfest. Except this one is more in camp form as opposed to, like, the amusement park, you know, a la, you know, Halloween Horror Nights. So I think in regards to, like, the overall setting, I much prefer the festival-type setting as opposed to, like, you know, campsite setting, at least with, you know, the way that they went about doing things. But it was an enjoyable watch, but I'm not gonna say it's like gonna be one of the standouts, but obviously, like, having the connection with the podcast was worth the watch alone. You know, maybe my score would have changed, you know, had we just not had like a guy character who, you know, didn't seem really convinced that you know, what was going on. You know, you have all these horror nerds at this camp just thinking like, oh man, oh, that's so cool, not realizing that that was actual blood and just not staged.
Well, yeah, when you have the wannabe bloody disgusting guy who is masquerading as a horror guy but's actually a corporate hack, yeah, it's kind of hard to dismiss it, but because we all got to watch it together, it was kind of fun. It just came out and it was like, everyone was like, did you see that? Did you see that? So, I mean, it made it super fun. Yeah. I mean, is it a great movie? No. Is it a fun movie? Yes. And maybe sometimes that's kind of all that matters. And you and I have discussed this, I think, more times than we can count. 2024 has been the year of meh so far. Mm-hmm. I don't have a 10 yet. You know, and I keep my tens pretty close to the vest, but I think I have 1.9. So, I mean, we're not doing real good. Now, my probably best recent thing is I was able to see through the Minneapolis Film Festival, Tiger Stripes. And Tiger Stripes, I gave it a 6.5. I think that's what it was. But for a foreign film, the subject matter is a young girl's coming of age, and they really put the coming of age right in your face. So you can't ignore it. It's impossible. So there's definitely, like, for me as a guy, there was some moments where it was like, oh boy, okay. But it's a cool story. Now, they call it a body horror movie. I don't think I necessarily agree with that. I called it more of a creature feature just with what they gave us. But that was really fun. I hope that one gets distributed. And then we also watched with our crew a movie called Herd. And it's a 2024 zombie movie. Not real well known and definitely not well reviewed. Which kind of confused me because for a zombie movie, it was really above board. Now, I know people talked a little bit about the story and, you know, how it was. There were some unflattering things said about it for a number of reasons that I'm not going to repeat because a lot of it was just stupidity and doesn't bear repeating. But one of those odd movies that takes on pretty much every sliver of social commentary that is current right now. And I'll say this, I thought it was pretty bold. to just do that, to address, I mean, and to not make it just a huge mess. You know, they address these things without making it a huge mess, which made it pretty fun. It, very character driven. And a lot of times with, you know, call it a low budget zombie movie, you don't see that. So that one was pretty good. I was happy we all watched that together.
Right on. And, you know, I know we were talking a little bit pre-show before Twisted Tuesday. But, you know, it was a pretty busy week since the last stream. Obviously, we both went out to go see Abigail in theaters, which was every bit as fun as you would have expected it to be. Like, that one definitely delivered one of the better flicks that have come out this year. But in regards to, like, new releases that hit, like, on demand, you know, one of the recommendations I gave you was a new Irish folk horror movie that just came out called All You Need Is Death, which the premise of that one is you're, like, following this couple who are working for some sort of, like, organization, and their whole ordeal is going around collecting and recording, like, these unheard songs before. And they're basically, like, trying to, like, hunt down this this one lady. They're looking for a particular singer. It turns out, you know, she's no longer with us, but her daughter is. And there's been this song that has been passed down basically, like, you know, through the family tree, but, like, it's only been passed down, like, through the women. Like, it's not for male consumption, but it's a very intriguing watch because, it's very different because, like, there's not a whole lot of, like, audiophile-based horror flicks out there, let alone the ones that are just, like, drawn into, like, the folklore aspect. But it's an interesting twist on kind of like romantic horror, if I'm being honest, because it does really talk about how, like, all-consuming, like, romance can be, and the way that they went about doing it was just so damn intriguing to me, and it really, like, drew me in, because, like, I can't really compare it to many other movies, which is great to see. And, you know, the timing of, you know, after just spending, like, the entire month here, you know, a couple of weeks ago, kind of, like, deep diving into The Fear of the Irish, you know, just made it that much more impactful for me. So that one is available on demand, so definitely go check that one out. I know there's, like, quite a few releases this week as well. You know, there's, like, Boy Kills World coming out, limited in theaters. We got another, like, spider movie hidden Shudder called, I think it's Infested, from the guy who's doing, like, the next Evil Dead movie, so I'm very curious to check that one out. That one's been getting some pretty good buzz online already. But yeah, it's been, you know, the recent watches, like, at least compared to, you know, what we have seen, have definitely been a step above the vast majority of 2024 so far. So I just want to see, like, all right, at what points are we going to get, like, I don't want to say, like, given this false sense of security, because I know we also have, like, another Tubi movie being added on Friday as well. So it's like, oh, man, buckle in, because it's probably going to be another, you know, 4.5 or, you know, maybe a 5 at the high end, you know, in that regard.
Well, you might be right, but at the same time, we've been talking a lot about Tubi, and it is funny how, I mean, Tubi has kind of become a mainstay in horror now. I mean, we have Shudder, right? And Shudder's great. But I think Shudder also tends to be a little bit more selective, where the, you know, the film board at Tubi is like, fuck it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you do get the occasional gem out of there. Like, I watched Bite on your recommendation, and I enjoyed that one. I thought it was pretty good. I watched Gacy on your recommendation. I did not like that one at all. That one sucked ass. Well, maybe not your recommendation. You said
it was on my list. Yeah,
it was on the list.
I didn't recommend that one.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, I think the nice thing about Tubi is it just is kind of the gift that keeps on giving. So, I mean, you know, what is, in the real world of films, you know, a 2B5, what is a 2B5 when it comes to, you know, a huge studio production, probably a 9, right? I mean, that's what a 2B5 is. So for me, as much as the studios have been letting me down, you know, with the exception of Abigail, because Abigail was, it was super fun, tons of action. I'm a pace guy. If the pace is slow, my brain wanders. The pace was fantastic. The characters were fantastic. Everything about it was either great or really good. Mm-hmm. You know, did it hit the 10 level? No, it didn't. But it was one of those movies where it's like, for me as a horror person, and as much as I watch, I needed something that was just going to come out and punch me in the face. And that's what Abigail did, which is to punch me right in the face, like, watch, motherfucker. just keep watching. And it did that. So it was really fun to watch. But there's so much out there. It's like, you know, I caught, there was an anthology called Horror Stories that was okay. There was Guess Who, which I honestly got to the end and I'm like, I don't even care who anymore. But then, yeah, for this week, and I meant to get to Handling the Undead last night, but honestly, I was just too goddamn tired. And our rabble-rousing crowd was like, what's our pre-show going to be? And it was like, all right, fuck it. I'm not going. Well, the hard part with the Minneapolis Film Festival is that a lot of the horror movies, the reason I saw Tiger Stripes is because it was at 4:40 in the afternoon.
Okay.
That's something where I can skirt out of work a little bit earlier and get there. I met my wife down there. She really enjoyed it too. But Handling the Undead is at 9:45. And it's in Minneapolis, in the midst of a bunch of construction with horseshit parking. And then again, it's in Minneapolis. So it's like, there's not a lot of motivators to go downtown in the middle of the fucking night. There's just not. I mean, because I'm a smarter person than that. So I wish they wouldn't do that. I wish they would have the old guy matinee for some of these horror movies. That would be great. They don't. It is what it is. You know, and I'm still, I don't want to go back on the Tubi thing, but it's like when you turned me on to that movie Cholo Zombies, mm-hmm. and I watched that and it was one of the funniest, most self-aware, at the same time, most racist movies I've ever seen. but it all made for a great package. So, I mean, that's we talk about the movies where you get together with your buddies and watch. That is one of those movies. And it's hilarious. And the main character there, I cannot remember his name, but that kid, he carries that movie so well. I mean, like even though he's a quote unquote cholo, he's got an acting future if he can, you know, break himself out of being the, you know, the Vato gangster guy. He's got a future because he did a great job in that. So I like Shudder, but I think when it comes to horror, I think long term, if you want quantity of content, because if you watch enough horror movies, you have to watch 10 to get one great one, mm-hmm. you know, and Shudder doesn't put enough out in a year, you know, for you to find 10 great ones. You might find two, whereas Tubi, they put enough out where you're going to find 10, 12, 15 great ones over the course of the year.
Well, I think part of that, too, though, is just how slow Shudder is at acquiring a lot of these films, because it seems like at least for new, like 2024 releases or things that are just coming out of like the film festivals, it's kind of more of a quarterly affair more than anything. Whereas like at least with Tubi, like it seems to be at least like once a month, like they're getting one of their originals like actually hit the streaming platform. But yeah, I would definitely agree. Like Shudder has definitely been more selective. But you know, a lot of it is just based on the fact that I think for a lot of people, like Shudder is basically been propped up still by, you know, the Last Drive-In, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it does seem like just like the frequency of the new releases isn't as common as it used to be. So for them to like change the format for the Last Drive-In and to stretch it out and do it bi-weekly, only do like one movie, you know, over the course of those 2 weeks, just like kind of like prolong the subscription base, really says a lot about kind of like, you know, just the state of these streaming services right now.
for me, there's a hard reality here. And when I use a subscription-based service, I need it to work because that's when I want it. And I ended up canceling my Shudder because I had so many technical problems with it. Like, I went in through my Prime membership and tried to use it, and it was just like, it would play the first 10 seconds of a movie, then it would lock up. You know, and after I think 4 or 5 help desk tickets to them, they were like, I was literally to that point where they're like, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again? And it's like, no, I never thought of that, you know? So it was like, okay, just never mind. I'm not going to do it anymore. But, you know, at the same time, I also know that, like, I know a couple of the, well, I know both the brothers from like DBS Films. And I know that when they put out, you know, they did Horror in the Forest and then they did A Cold Grave. For them, they always want to get, you know, the Prime rentals and things like that. And they have a Discord where they encourage that. And their members of their Discord are, they're unbelievably loyal. But at the same time, they like Tubi because Tubi is just exposure out the ass. Right. So, you know, that they will use that. So I whatever Tubi is doing and how it's still free, I honestly don't know. It honestly doesn't make any sense in my head how it's still free. And if they got to the point where they said, okay, hey, guess what? Tubi is now $5 a month. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would care. I honestly don't think I would care. Unlike, you know, Amazon, where I have to pay for it. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to give you some ads too. So go fuck yourself, you know, and you have no choice. But like I've said before, we do have some nice people that are filing lawsuits on our behalf. And when it comes to claim my $4.76 that I'm going to get from that class action lawsuit, I will have my hand out. You can bet your ass.
Yeah, to use towards your Tubi subscription or whatever they do end up changing it. But yeah, you know, it's just one of those things. It's like for the longest time, it's like, yeah, we, you know, we're paying for Prime. And then they're like, oh, yeah, well, like starting on such and such date, we're going to have limited ads. And then you're like, wait, what? And then I remember when the first time on Twisted Tuesday, when we got an ad, I'm just like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. I forgot this was actually a thing. And then it just got to the point where, you know, like, I've been watching on Tubi, like, on the smart TV, thinking like, oh, fuck, I forgot to, like, log in. So, like, I'm probably gonna get hit with, like, 8 billion fucking ads. That hasn't been the case. So it's just like, I can't really see a difference between me being logged in and not. Only difference being, like, if I, you know, stop a play for whatever reason and, you know, like, go do something else and then come back to it. If I'm not logged in, there's no, like, playback from where you were, like you would if you were logged in. That's really the only difference, at least on Tubi, from what I've seen. But, you know, it's so funny that we're at a point now where it's, like, Tubi really has become, like, the home for horror. Like, they have more than, honestly, it does feel like every streaming service combined at this point in time.
Oh, without a doubt, too. And they have everything from your really popular mainstream, like your Terrifier 2 and things like that, to some of the low-budgiest crap you're ever going to find. And let's face it, as horror people, 70% of what comes out, maybe 80% of what comes out, is low-budget garbage, okay? And I'm using the term garbage lovingly because I love garbage horror. I'm always going to love garbage horror. It just is what it is. But kind of like we talked about before, and especially with like getting into 2024, it's like I finally got into a place where I used to be something of a completionist. It's like if I started a movie, I had to finish it. And kind of what I figured out is that I have to be able to turn that piece of my brain off and just go, okay, this is crap, and just go, nope. And move on, remove from my list. Don't ever show this to me again. If possible, give me the little hypno wiper for Men in Black and I can forget that I ever saw this. But that's okay because that's what a lot of horror is. But we've said it before. I still want these people to keep making it because for every 10 turds you get a gem, and the gems are what make it all worth it. So I'm still happy, you know, at 50 years old, and I've been watching horror since I was 8 years old. I am still happy doing the breaststroke through all the shit to get to the good ones. And it's well worth my effort. You know, things like Shudder. I mean, I think you're right about, you know, the drive-in is what's keeping it alive, and then the occasional somebody at Shudder knows how to cherry pick movies. They really do. You know, Late Night with the Devil was a cherry pick. Somebody cherry picked that one, but they did it because it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, so but is that enough to keep it going long term? And was it enough for my $5.99? No, definitely not.
Absolutely. And, you know, just on the hopping on the garbage horror, you know, I was like browsing Screambox here after Twisted Tuesday last night. And I came across something that really piqued my interest. Now, I have not watched this movie yet. I had basically seen a couple of tidbits on Twitter. Mostly people talking about how, like, this movie was only made for $5,000, but it was one of those moments where it's like, I'm on Screambox on their website, and I basically just stopped, and I was just, like, so unabashedly, like, ready to watch this movie, just based off the title alone, and it's Cocaine Crabs from Outer Space. Now,
yes.
Obviously, when Cocaine Bear came out, there was kind of like I'm not going to say a surplus of, like, B-monster movies with cocaine involved in them, but there were definitely quite a few of them that came out around this time, and I saw this, and I was like, you know what? This is going to be a perfect drunk watch, because I love dumb movies, and this definitely looks like it's going to be one, but the poster just had me cracking up so much, so I don't have high expectations. This could be one that I might decide to turn off. But just the fact that there's an idea out there involving cocaine crabs from outer space, I am at least buying into it. So we'll see what that one has to entail. But God, you know, I love B-movies. And, you know, anytime you throw cocaine at any sort of creature, you can just kind of strap in for the ride, because you don't know quite how bloodthirsty they might become.
It's really amazing that we have effectively, because this doesn't happen that often in horror, somebody created a new genre, okay? And it was drug-addled animals of some sort, or drug-addled crustaceans, or drug-addled carnivores. And, I mean, we did have, you know, things like you know, Thanksgiving, Poultrygeist, stuff like that, where there was, but to have Cocaine Bear come out and have somebody mix the two, and then the fact that it was loosely based on a true story, I mean, you know, the Cocaine Bear didn't go on a rampage, it just ate a bunch of cocaine and fucking OD'd and died, which is, you know, what happens to drug addicts, so there's your future if you're a drug addict. But having seen Meth Gator was 1,000 times more fun than it should have been. And it was, again, not a 10, but so fantastically good slash bad that it was just fantastic. So seeing this one, it's like, and I want to say somebody put this, I think this was in our Discord somewhere. Didn't somebody put this in there? Yes, well, they did. It was you. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but it seems like the Discord was like, oh fuck yes, let's go. So, I mean, I think everyone's right there for it. So, I mean, maybe we'll have to have it as a pre-stream watch one of these nights.
Yeah, and then when that happens, everyone can blame you but not me.
Well, I don't fucking care. I am not living my life based on the opinions of others, not even a little freaking bit. Now, I know we had talked, and of course, I've said this before, I drink, so my memory is not exactly what it could be. We had talked about a pre-stream for tomorrow, but I cannot for the life of me remember what the hell it was. Do you have any recollection of what it might be? Because we talked about it last night, and I was like, that would be... Oh.
Well, I had recommended All You Need Is Death.
That's what it was, yes. Okay, but I think Cocaine Crabs might be more fun. Maybe I'll put up a little impromptu poll and see what people think. Because that could be fun. I don't know. I always struggle with this because I want people to have a good time, but at the same time it's like, do I want you to have a good time with a piece of crap or have a good time with a good movie? And it's like, yeah, well, exactly. But it's like, you never know what the audience is feeling. So I guess we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, we're going to be 20 minutes in and, you know, I'm going to be, you know, asking you, like, how much for you to turn this off. You know, it could be one of those situations. I don't know. But either way, I'm in. Count me in. That definitely seems like it's going to be something that I'm going to enjoy to at least some degree. But anyways, on tap tonight, we're returning to camp for The Burn-In, released in 1981, which follows a former summer camp caretaker who has been horribly burned from a prank gone wrong, lurks around an upstate New York summer camp, beat on killing the teenagers responsible for his disfigurement. All right, so it should come as no surprise that this is based off of a pretty common, you know, campfire tale. And, you know, the original title was the Cropsey Maniac. They did not end up going with that, and probably for the best, because The Burn-In is a much better title, even though there is somewhat a lack of fire, although there is a flamethrower, which I will say at the end of the day, I think this movie has one of the weirdest final fights I have ever seen, and it's probably the only reason why I would deduct any points from it, because other than that, it's a fantastic movie. But The Burn-In was inspired by the Cropsey urban legend from the Hudson Valley in upstate New York, which, again, you know, this is often told around campfires, and, you know, that's why the movie was set at a summer camp, and a character was actually called Cropsey. So, you know, you already have that connection, as is. Now, prior to directing The Burn-In, you had, Tony, Malam, who was mostly known for documentaries, and that is why they kind of, like, took this approach, with the movie to make it, you know, a little bit more gritty, almost voyeuristic, when it comes to, like, the approach of the killer. Now, of course, with the special effects, our attention was drawn towards Tom Savini, and, you know, he basically turned down an offer to do Friday the 13th Part 2, even after doing the effects for the original, which, of course, was 1 year earlier. And, you know, Savini had reportedly only 3 days to come up with the bird makeup for Cropsey's face. And, you know, the end result, he was largely unsatisfied with how it looked when all was said and done. And I think for a lot of people, seeing, like, the burn effects, you know, when we do have, you know, the killer reveal, was kind of lackluster. But, you know, if the Wizard of Gore himself was not happy with the end result, it's no wonder that's kind of, like, one of the things that people kind of dog on this movie about, even though, for the most part, like, this is a very solid slasher of its time, but often one that gets overshadowed by an, you know, extreme, like, amount by Friday the 13th.
Oh, that's fair. I mean, because it's, I mean, it's not, it's, I know this is, like, one of your favorites, so I'm trying hard not to, like, you know, drop it in the litter box and scrape litter over it. But I mean, it is kind of a Friday the 13th movie. I mean, it really is. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, I think the original stunt where they put, like, the skull with the candles in the eyes just to, like, freak the guy out, I mean, it was super over the top, but at the same time, in my head, it seemed like a very reasonable prank, except for, like, maybe, like, the lit candles, and especially for the guy that keeps his gas cans next to his bed. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was a little bit like, huh? Like, why is that there? All things being equal, it's a solid start, and at least you've got something where it gives you, as a viewer, a place to say, well, okay, either A, this guy is going over the top killing, or these fucking kids have it coming. And you get to sort of pick your place, and it gives you that. But it's also, it's very camp slasher. I mean, even you go back to take the sleepaway camps. I mean, there's always something that it gives you a place where you get to decide for yourself how you're going to feel and who you're rooting for. And I mean, I'm a horror person. 9 times out of 10, I'm rooting for the killer. That's just because that's who I am. But this is one where it's like, okay, just because, and I don't want to keep bringing up the B word, and the B word being bully, but just because you were a little bit different or whatever else and people decided to fuck with you, it was okay that you died. And so, or you allegedly died anyway. You went into the hospital and then escaped. And, but this is one of those ones where it's like, yeah, dude, I'm perfectly content sharpening your shears for you. I'll keep them sharp. Just I'll be in the back, you know, I'll be your apprentice, and we can just keep going, and let's see what kind of damage you can cause. Now the whole cropsy thing, I think it's interesting that that's where they started. Mm-hmm. And mostly because, I mean, cropsy is, if you look at the legend, cropsy is kind of the farthest away from camp you could actually get. I mean, the true cropsy legend has nothing to do with camp, right? And when all was said and done, it's one of those things where it turns into someone who's basically a child kidnapper and murderer that was like on Staten Island. And it's like, Staten Island is not where I would go to camp, you know? So ultimately, I mean, changing the name was smart, because I think they would have really sort of collapsed their audience to a very small circle of people. I mean, it might have been super popular, but at the same time, it's like the rest of us might not have cared, because this is 1981 and, you know, there's no internet, and, you know, urban legends are, or were at least, you know, slower to pass in the realm than they are now.
You know, we'll say, like, on that note too, like, they were talking about how, like, like, this movie did do fairly well in, like, the Buffalo area, at least with the box office. Wasn't like the biggest box office hit, kind of like, you know, across the states, but you know, did earn its money back, and then some eventually. But as I was saying, like, the finale of this movie is very intriguing, if only for kind of like the setting of it, because they did shoot it in like this real abandoned copper mine, and you know, the problem with that was, like, you know, it was so dusty, filled with debris, that the director was actually having coughing fits for weeks after filming the movie. Now, initially, they had the idea of, like, you know, shooting the climax inside of a cave, but, you know, they had basically scouted 2 different caves, one of which ended up collapsing. The other one, and, you know, this could have been fun, was filled with bats.
God.
So it's like pick your poison, you know, in that regard. But you know, I'll talk about the finale when we get there, but it's just one of the scenes where it's like, I still can't get over just how much of a missed opportunity the third act of this movie is. But it is what it is. But yeah, so the opening pring of the movie, as you mentioned, like, yeah, I don't know, like, too many people who, like, sleep with the, a can of gasoline next to their bed, but, you know, I'm also not a caretaker at a summer camp, so I don't know if that's a common theme. But, you know, what this movie does is, like, at least when it's setting up, like, that final fight, like, obviously there's a reason that Cropsy is going after the one guy, because he was, like, basically, like, the ringleader of the original group of campers who conducted, you know, this prank on him. But, you know, after we have this initial prank and he's getting engulfed in flames, you know, seeing, like, that first image of Cropsy just completely up in flames in his suit, like, that is a very visceral shot, all things considered. But then we have, like, these sort of, like, time jumps, you know, initially... we are taken, I'm trying to think, it was like a week after the attack, and we're like at the local hospital where, you know, we have, we're introduced to like this just absolute asshole orderly, you know, one of the new residents, and, you know, they're basically like taking a peek inside of Cropsy's room. And obviously, like, the whole setup here is just to get, like, a cheap jump scare, you know, right at the start, too. But it's one of the scenes where it's like, oh, man, wait until you get a load of this freak. You know, then, like, you're not going to be the same. He's basically, like, this sideshow attraction of this hospital. And, of course, you know, we have, like, the burnt arm reaching out to, you know, grab a hold of the one guy for, you know, our jump scare bit there. But then we take another, like, you know, time jump where it's like, okay, we're like 5 years in down the road. Cropsy is finally being released from the hospital. Where, you know, obviously he's like these field skin grouse that have just left him horribly disfigured, you know, because of this. And the first scene he does seems so, like, weird to me because it doesn't match the tone of the entirety of the film. You know, he basically approaches a hooker. You know, she brings him up to her apartment, basically, and then he just attacks her after she sees how horribly disfigured he is. So it's just like, at that point, it's just like, okay, like, what are we actually doing here? Because, like, for the most part, when we think of, you know, 80s slashers, you know, there's always going to be, like, that sleaze aspect of, you know, the early 80s slashers, and especially, like, the New York-based ones. I mean, obviously, like, Maniac and New York Ripper definitely come to mind in that regard. But, like, for this movie, and just to see where things end up, like, it just didn't really match anything else that happened afterwards. So it's just, like, it feels like we're watching almost an entirely different movie from that point on.
For me, it was that moment where you had to make a choice about how you felt about our killer. And a lot of horror movies, especially 80s horror movies, they should come with a piece of paper that you have to sign when you see them, and it should be called the morality clause. And how do you feel about certain things? And so there are people in the world that are okay with the killing of a hooker because she's a hooker. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not, per se, but there are people that are okay with it. But I think that's where it starts to force you to make your decision. And I think that's why those scenes are there. Because, to your point, it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie. It's not, this is where I think it tries to differentiate itself from the Friday the 13th and the other things like that, where it's about, you know, horny kids going out and getting laid. This is just about vengeance. And it's like, so what, or how far is it okay to go to have your vengeance? So I think this is the moment. This is the moment where you have to go, which side am I on? And, you know, as much as I was okay with this guy waxing everybody else because they effectively cooked him like a Thanksgiving turkey, the killing of the hooker, it was like, say what you want, that's her living. She's just out plying her wares, you know, and it's like, there's not a lot of reason to do that. So it's kind of was one of the spots in the movie where I think it was there because it wanted to give you a choice, but it also was, it didn't fit real well. Mm-hmm. It was like, so I've escaped from a hospital because I'm seriously, seriously burned. You probably can't actually touch any of my skin because I'm so badly burnt, but I'm going to go out and bang a hooker. I mean, it doesn't make a ton of sense. But I think it was the movie's morality clause moment.
Yeah. But it's, at the same time too, it's just like, oh, well, you like to do it with the lights off. Well, yeah, he's horribly burnt, but obviously she's still got a good look on that. You know, he ends up stabbing her and basically like throwing her out the window, which is always fun. But yeah, it's interesting because, like, a lot of these movies kind of, like, take the approach of, like, okay, we're going to target these women in this line of work, or otherwise just go after people who, quote, won't be missed. You know, like, the people who, like, don't have a family or don't have anyone to fall back to, or no one who people are going to notice goes missing, sort of approaches to it. But it does, like, kind of, like, set the tone. But what's also interesting here too is, you know, obviously, like, with the comparisons to Friday the 13th, you know, Friday the 13th was shot in a way where it's like the killer is basically, you know, like this unknown adversary, for, you know, the majority of the runtime. You know, we didn't really know, like, who the killer was, what the sort of motivations were at the time. But obviously, like, we know what the reveal is later on in the movie. And, like, one of the reasons why Tom Savini, like, did not, like, stay attached to the project for at least part two was because he disagreed with the idea of, like, having such a massive time jump with Jason himself, because he was a kid in the first movie, and then, you know, seeing him as an adult in the second one was not to his liking. But, you know, here we know who the killer is, like, just out of the get-go. You know, we have our burnt caretaker, so... You know, we don't really have, like, that sense of, you know, wonderment about the killer itself, which is fine. But it also, you know, with that open kill, just kind of puts us in this position where it's like, all right, well, we just basically have a murderous dick going around, and he's going to go back to, you know, the camp roots at this point to, you know, get his revenge on, you know, all these little shits who basically ruined his life. And, of course, you know, killing anyone that, you know, stands in his way. Now, this brings us to the campsite, which is Camp Stonewater, where we get introduced to our potential victims in all of this. So we have our head counselors, who are Todd and Michelle. They spend a lot of their time kind of like bickering over how to handle certain unruly elements among the campers. You know, we have, like, our goofball, who is Dave. You know, we also have, he's also, like, kind of like the ringleader for the Misfits, and that, of course, is being played by Jason Alexander for his first acting role, which, you know, for the most part, like, that's probably one of the more known things about this movie. I know why a lot of people do seek it out, obviously because of his, you know, Seinfeld fame. We also have Woodstock, who's kind of like the sidekick. We have Alfred, who, you know, his response to being bullied is to basically stalk his bully's girlfriend and watch her while she showers. That great way to get back at him. I don't that's really make no sense.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing at all with that.
But I can't blame a guy for trying. Not the most sensible tactic, but, you know, he still gets his show. You have Glazer, who is the bully, and kind of like your standard lunkhead, who is basically all brain, all brawn, no brains, and is constantly trying to get together with one of the blondes to mostly no avail for a while until she eventually kind of like gives in. And then we have Eddie, who is basically, for lack of a better term, he's kind of like more of a predator in the making. He and his girlfriend Karen are, I mean, Karen is basically just a very stereotypical, like, slasher victim. You know, you basically know that she's going to end up dead, you know, the first time she opens her mouth, because she just has that vibe to her. But either way, like, the birdie is mostly notable for, you know, beginning the careers of the unknowns, who would later, you know, go on to become big stars, like Holly Hunter, who also appears for a small part as one of the young campers. But, of course, it's mostly known for, you know, Jason Alexander and Fisher Stevens, who stood out there. And, you know, they would obviously go on to bigger and better things at this point.
Well, it's funny that you talk about predators in this movie, because I would argue that our pal Glazer, who is also King Douchebag, is also something of a predator. Yeah. But I do love the fact that this story sort of gives him at least a figurative comeuppance, is that he finally is able to, you know, score Sally, but he's a early squirter, as they say. And I think, I mean, it had been a while since I watched this movie, and I was like, I knew something happened to him, but I couldn't remember what it was. When that happened, I just about fell out of my chair laughing. And I'm like, I'm leaning back in my chair going, that's right, asshole. You just, that's what you get. So, I mean, that's perfect. But going through the characters in this movie, I mean, there are so many people. It's another one of those movies, I think, where they cast everybody just right. We had It's kind of like April Fool's Day we talked about. There is a perfect cast of characters. There's kind of an equal representation to all the different people in life that we all know and that we all encounter every day. Now, granted, it's a camp movie, right? So it's more high school driven than it is anything else. But I'm sorry, I knew all these assholes in high school. I knew every single one of them. I could probably name them if you gave me time. But I also think, I mean, because the one thing you talked about was Tom Savini and not liking the time jump. I mean, this movie in and of itself did do a time jump. It was 5 years, you know? So it wasn't like they were completely just dumping the script. But at the same time, other than the hooker thing, which is still weird, it still doesn't make a ton of sense. The lights off, I like the lights off too. That's fine. But I mean, it doesn't completely hold to the script that would be, you know, a Friday the 13th-esque movie. And to your point about we know who the killer is, we know what the motivations are. But that just forces them to focus more on having decent characters and having decent kills. And this movie does that. Mm. And it does that in spades. So ultimately, it's pretty hard to argue with. And for the history of these kind of movies and the characters that they give us, I'm always going to love the fact that pretty much at every turn in this movie, guys like Glazier, something doesn't go his way. And this is one of those rare movies where I'm like, okay, there's the muscle bound lunkhead and oh, nope, he fell off the dock. Oh, nope, the girls are laughing at him. Oh, nope. Oh, he popped early. It's just, it's beautiful that they take that guy and just kind of push his face into the mud versus, you know, make him come out on top and just go do the big flex at the end. You know, he doesn't get that. And it's one of the things that I like about this movie.
Yeah. Don't worry, Sally. It'll be better next time. Buddy, there ain't going to be a next time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You can't. Yeah. You show up to a date early once, you don't get a second date. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
But anyways, of course, you know, this movie does have its gratuity in regards to the nudity and, of course, you know, blood, because it is a slasher after all. But it had just so much gore in it that the Burning did end up making its way onto, you know, the video nasty list in, you know, the United Kingdom. So it was one of the, like, the banned movies of there. And you know, it was one of those scenes where it's like, okay, well, like we need to heavily edit the shit out of this movie in order to avoid getting the dreaded X rating that was on there initially because of the infamous raft scene in The Burning, which, you know, I think if you're talking about like any sequence in this movie that people remember, obviously like the reveal of like what's actually on the raft after they go missing is one of the more striking sequences out of there. And of course, you know, it also sets up for a pretty decent jump scare in that regard. But for me, I think the one thing that this movie does that not a lot of movies really did at the time in regards to like setting up the finale is we don't really have that sort of final girl in The Burning. Here it's more, you know, Cropsy trying to get back at Todd. So he's kind of like our final boy in this situation because he does end up kidnapping Alfred, who is basically like the kid that like Todd is constantly like sticking his neck out for because, you know, he did kind of like land himself in hot water after, you know, creeping on the brunette in the shower. You know, just trying to give her a scare. You know, he didn't mean any harm, as he would like to say. So we have this moment where Alfred is essentially being used as bait to lure Todd into, you know, the abandoned copper mine for, you know, the final showdown. And I thought that was very interesting, not only just in the setting, but just knowing, like, okay, like, anytime we think of slashers, we do think of, you know, having that final girl type moment. We don't really have that here.
Well, I mean, we do and we don't, I guess. It's probably one of those rare ones where we get out at the end, and I'm not going to say that this movie started it, but where we we walk away from like the big finale and there's more than one person left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you know, when we say final girl, we say that for a reason, because other than her and some cops and some paramedics, everybody else is dead, you know? And this is one of those rare movies where they basically didn't smoke every single person. Most of them, but not every single one, you know. I know, you know, Alfred gets the old flamethrower. But it's like watching, I don't know, something about watching Cropsey's body burn and the purposeful finality. It was kind of something different, because it's not, you know, the slasher taking an axe to the head, or the slasher getting stabbed and falling out of a window, or it's one of those ones where it's like, yeah, this is the end. And it's like, that's kind of, especially for the time when, you know, you've had Halloween come out, you've had Friday the 13th come out, and they left those things very open-ended, because it's like, well, what if people like it and we could make more? Mm-hmm. You know, this movie didn't do that. They're like, here's the end. Something different. I mean, something different than we normally see from movies of the time, where, you know, horror is getting popular and we have to make sure that we write a story that is open-ended in case it's popular and we can make more. Now, truth be told, at the end, we do have another group of kids that are talking about, you know, Cropsey over the campfire. So, I mean, you could kind of say that that's maybe our open door into the next one. But I mean, like, I like movies where they get creative and bring the killer back, but when the guy is a pile of fucking ashes on the floor, like, I don't know. You know, I think you take ashes and you have them compressed into a diamond and you wear it in a necklace to celebrate grandma, right? I mean, you don't, other than that, it's not a way to resurrect a horror franchise.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe it gets struck by lightning because, you know, the ceiling of the abandoned copper mine, you know, just caved in.
Well, I watched a movie once where you could bring a nuclear bomb into an abandoned copper mine and that would pretty much seal it off and nobody would be affected otherwise. So, you know, and there'd be butterflies in the background. So, you know what? Weirder shit's happened.
But yeah, in regards to the kill count in this movie, since we are talking about, you know, surviving victims in all this, you know, as mentioned, you know, we had the prostitute as her first kill, who basically gets stabbed in the stomach with a pair of scissors. And it should come as no surprise that that kind of like plays, I think it runs its course throughout the entirety of the movie, because garden shears are, you know, the weapon of choice for our killer, whether it is, you know, mm-hmm. cutting people's throats open, their chest open, stabbing them in the stomach. We also have a moment where, like, the garden shears are, like, shoved down Eddie's throat as well, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, we have, like, head slicing. There's, you know, just about any way you can think of killing someone with garden shears, this movie does. And we even have, like, the cutting off of the sausage fingers in one regard. And having a little bit of that, like, stage blood-type moment with the squirts coming out of the separate fingers, which is fun in its own right. But the third act of the movie is just one of those scenes where it's like, every time I watch this, I try to forget how much I don't like the third act. And it's just like, I know what's going to happen. And I still am just left with just like a weird taste in my mouth every time I watch the third act of the movie. Because like, obviously, like the whole point of the final showdown with Todd is because, you know, he was the leader of the original group of campers that burned Cropsey in the first place. And he's, you know, kind of like going back and, you know, picking off all the campers in that regard. But just the idea of, okay, we're going to shoot this. We're going to be in a copper mine. Our killer is going to come out with a flamethrower as a burn victim, for one. It's just like, I don't know if I can consider this an eye for an eye type moment, because like every part of me would want to believe that like Cropsey would want nothing to fucking do with fire for the rest of his life. Like, not want to, like, deal with matches, not smoke, not anything. But here he is coming in with a flamethrower in close quarters against Todd, who, mind you, has an axe. And just knowing, like, they are in tight, you know, spaces here, I would let to be, like, believed that a flamethrower, especially with a range advantage, would be the better of the two weapons. So it's just like, seeing the way that things, like, pan out, like, every part of my brain is like, yeah, that doesn't make any fucking sense. But, you know, it's a movie. I know. It's ridiculous in its own right, but it's just one of those scenes where it's like, it's hard for me to look past at times when I watch this.
There certainly is a little bit of a bringing a knife to a gunfight vibe to it, and I sort of appreciate that. At the same time, there's a little piece of me, and maybe this is me trying to be a humanist for once in my life. It's like, if I've already been horribly burned, like, maybe the point is that the fire is just not going to scare me. Like, and not only is it not going to scare me, but it's going to become my weapon of choice. Mostly because this is how you fucked me up in the first place.
So you're seeing it more as a token of empowerment.
Exactly. So it seems a little bit apropos that it's like, so this is what you did to me. And now, it's granted, it's not a moldy, maggot-eaten skull with candles in the eyes. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, it's that, like, take the power back moment. Like, you know, I'm Karopsi and I'm here to stay. You know, that, like, I just, something about it was laughable, but at the same time, like, yeah, okay. Oh, sure, why not, you know? And your point is not lost. It's like, it's, you know, it's, you know, Norman Bates not wanting to work in a cheap motel. It's, you know, Freddy not wanting to work in a boiler room. It's Jason not wanting to go to camp. It makes sense. But at the same time, when you flip the script and just turn it back on itself, it's like, well, shit, why not? I'm kind of okay with it.
The other part of it, too, though, is the fight itself is drawn out for quite a bit of time, too, which is also kind of surprising. And, of course, this is after Cropsey is able to capture Alfred and basically, like, pins him up against the wall using the gardening shears. Of course, he does eventually gain the advantage, but that's when, you know, Alfred is able to free himself. Basically embedding Cropsey's own garden shears into his back. And, you know, that, you know, will kind of, like, lead into the whole, you know, final scare moment. Because, you know, when it comes to any, like, horror villain, he always has to come back to you know, try to get that last scare in. Only for Todd to bury the axe in his skull. But, you know, What's great about this is, you know, we have kind of like the throwing salt on a wound moment, like adding insult to injury, when Alfred picks up the flamethrower and just absolutely torches the fuck out of Cropsey's corpse on top of that, too. So it's like, well, let's see you come back from that one.
Well, one of those rare times where somebody actually makes sure, you know, like I mean, and again, turning somebody into complete ashes, I don't know what else you could possibly do, you know, short of, you know, sifting through the ashes and then putting them in a nice vase and handing them to your mother. I don't know how you could make more sure. So, again, this movie knows what it is. It's present. It's honest. And it is not being made on the pretense of, let's make sure we can make enough money so we can make another one. They're telling a story. They put a pin in it. It's done. And I'm kind of okay with it. I mean, it's now is it the greatest movie ever? No, it's not. But it's also it's super fun. It goes out of its way to acknowledge exactly what it is. It's a camp slasher. But it's a camp slasher that has all of the right kind of fun. It has the camp kids doing things. They're doing things in the water. They're peeping on girls showering. I mean, come on. That just what would happen, especially when the showers are outdoors. So fucking points for that. That was awesome. But it's not it's not trying to be fake, and it's not trying to be more than it is, and it's just people making a movie that understand, like, we have a guy who was a camp guy and was a geek and everybody hated him, and these things happened, like, good, bad, or otherwise, and apparently when you come out of a five-year coma, your first instinct is to kill a hooker. I mean, all these things that sort of don't make sense, but at the same time, it's like, it's not that hard to constitute in your mind that, yeah, that's probably what I'd do. Yeah, I'd be pissed, you know? So, I mean, it's all ultimately okay. And this is one of those rare movies where you walk away from it. And still, other than killing the hooker, because I'm not sure what the hooker had to do with anything other than, again, our pivotal morality junction. If people set me on fire, I'd be pissed. I want to kill somebody, you know? So, like, yeah, let's do it. And if I get to peep in on a couple of girls in the shower and watch some babes get their canoe badge or whatever the fuck it is that they were doing, why not? You know?
Yeah, I'm okay with it. You know, of course, like, any Twisted Tuesday selection wouldn't be complete without some sort of, like, a montage involved, whether it's a montage of all the girls, Heckling Glacier, or gathering wood to build a raft after the canoes go missing. But, you know, there's always got to be something kind of, like, thrown in there. But I think the part that, like, really cracks me up, though, is, like, just knowing that this is a camp set. And, of course, with Jason Alexander's character, you know, him being, like, one of the older members at the camp, like, he's kind of like the runner. Like, he's the one going out into the town to gather supplies for the camp members, whether it's, you know, porno mags or, you know, cigarettes or, you know, rubbers. And of course, you know, Glacier takes offense because he didn't buy the right ones, and, you know, Jason basically tells him, hey man, like, you know, this is what you get. Like, if you want them yourself, like, go out and buy them. And of course, you know, Glacier's pretty self conscious about, you know, actually going out to buy condoms.
Well, gee, I wonder why. Well, yeah, Jason Alexander is pretty much our Red from Shawshank Redemption. Mm-hmm. That's what he is. But he does it with a flair and a cockiness that adds some humor to the movie. It's one of those things where it's perfect, you know, and, you know, imagine you're in prison and you order something and it's not exactly perfect. Of course, you're going to bitch about it a little bit, but at the end, what the fuck are you going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't go on Amazon reviews and say, I didn't get the exact condoms that I wanted and they weren't the right color and Amazon refunded my money and everything's fine. Doesn't work that way. Right. So, I mean, that's kind of the beauty of it with the things that he is willing to go out and procure. It's another one of those things in the movie where it just makes it fun, because when I was a kid and went to camp, there was never a guy that wouldn't got that stuff. I mean, you showed up at 8 a.m. and you got your breakfast. You showed up at noon and you got your lunch. You showed up at 5 and got your dinner. And beyond that, it was, you know, trying to learn to tie knots, trying not to cut your fingers off with your knife while you're doing whatever else. And just, like, I mean, ultimately trying to survive. And he was the guy that kind of made the camp, like, palatable for everybody, you know? So there's always that guy. He was the cruise director, as it were. So, but he was fun, and people made do with what he brought. And that was honestly even more fun.
Yeah, it was also the one to make sure that Alfred was going to get his comeuppance against Glacier as well, using the little pea shooter, you know, over at the dock.
Oh, that was... Well, but that's where we finally get our moment, like our first real moment of Glacier, this big tough guy who gets shot in the ass, panics, falls in the water, and then all of the girls laugh at him. But for the simpler, the guys that don't fit in, the guys that don't get the gal, whatever else, that's exactly what you need. You need that guy to get a moment where he gets brought down a peg. And it's beautiful. It's just fucking beautiful.
And of course, this comes after, you know, Glacier's basically asking Sally to, like, go for a swim. And, you know, she declines. And, you know, Glacier has him over. He's just like, why not? And of course, you know, she basically tells him, oh, because, you know, I don't want to get my hair wet. And then, you know, all the girls are, you know, laughing along after, you know, the very obvious rejection at that point doesn't stop Leisure from trying again at that point in time, but perfect setup in that regard. So it's kind of like just putting him in his place on more than one front and back in this case when he gets dumped into the water and shot in the ass.
Well, but that's I think that's the one thing that this movie, maybe even this genre of movies, but I'll point out this movie specifically, that as a people and as a group, and it's maybe not so likely these days, but I think back then it definitely was, where with a given situation, you could tear anybody down. Mm-hmm. And it was not hard. Now, is it always the person that deserves it? I mean, probably not. In this case, it was a guy that had it fucking coming. And when you see it, I mean, you can't do anything but tip back in your chair and just send a slow clap. Just like, yes, thank you. Because people like him are the people that people like me like to hate. And I've always hated, you know? And it's probably the one thing that is, that really sets it apart from, like, that makes it not a Friday the 13th movie. Mm-hmm. In the Friday the 13th movies, they never really went out of their way to give you, like, a buffo jock guy. They a lot of them didn't do that. And at least not a buffo hated jock guy. At least he was semi-nice and semi-reasonable. Whatever. This guy was just an asshole. So whenever I can see the asshole just literally take 12 for the team, I'm okay with it. And this guy, he freaking had it coming. Glazier, you can go eat a bag of dicks. You honestly can.
Yeah, because whether it was through Sally's rejections, the girls laughing at him, getting shot in the ass, or even being confronted by Todd, too, at one point, you know, after he was like kind of like picking on Alfred, to really having another like comeuppance type of a moment in that regard. But yeah, all in all, like The Burden, like I'm not gonna say like it's in like my top five, obviously, like for like an older slasher, at least in the earlier part of the 80s, you know, it does enough things differently that helps make it stand out. But it's just the absolute sheer ridiculousness of the third act is probably why it isn't in my top five. But, you know, for a viewing experience, just seeing Jason Alexander and seeing what he brings on screen is definitely worth the watch alone. And, of course, the canoe scene in particular is definitely worth it in its own right. So definitely go check this one out. It is streaming on, I think we watched it on Shudder, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, if you're fair about this one, I think what you're saying about the third act is absolutely fair. At the same time, for movies of that era, it did things differently. Mm-hmm. And that's why it kind of stands out. And you're like, what? Why aren't we just going through the kills? Why do we have all these people that are, you know, all of a sudden banding together, you know? And at the same time, it's like, if you look at a Friday the 13th, it's like, it's a camp, but the overall number of cast members tends to be smaller too. And this one had a pretty hefty cast to work with. There was a lot of people. So to take all these people and to force this big collective into the situation and have them work together for the greater good. And, you know, we're all trying to just get back and survive and to do all these things. It's, I think, is what differentiates it from your typical camp slasher. It kind of takes it out of that zone and puts it into its own little place. Now, you know, I don't want to call it the, you know, the company getaway slasher, because that's not really what it is. But at the same time, it makes it different. So while I can understand your problems with the third act, I think the third act is also what makes it different than a lot of other ones, you know, and especially now we're in a copper mine and everyone has a goddamn flamethrower for some, like, what? I mean, but it, you know, it's a slasher movie. You have to at some point suspend reality and just be like, okay, I just got to kind of hang on and see what's going to happen next.
Yep. Absolutely. But looking ahead, I know we are wrapping up the month and, you know, we wanted to save a particular movie for last. Obviously, we had a very good idea of what we wanted to start with. We had a really good idea of what we wanted to finish with. And, you know, for our final episode of the month, we will be deep diving into Carrie, which, You know, talk about third acts in movies. Still to this day, Carrie has probably my favorite finale of, like, any movie.
Oh, without a doubt. And I'll tell you this, and I said this before, this is not going to be a new thing to you. Read the book because it's better. Mm-hmm. The finale is better in the book. This finale is phenomenal. In the book, it's actually better. I brought this one because I think there's lots of people that talk about Stephen King. I don't think there's a lot of people that talk about his movies without mentioning his name. Mm-hmm. And this one is particularly good. And it has so well held up the test of time. Because as a person who has grown up, gone to high school, gone through all the things that happened, and this is a very narrow window of time, right? But it also is something that everybody can relate to, whether it's having an overbearing parent, whether it's having a high school and an administration that doesn't seem to give a shit, that doesn't even bother to know your name. Whether it's being, you know, maybe you're lucky enough that, you get the attention of the hot boy in school, but the people that fuck with you, and then what kind of emotion it ends up bringing out of you. It's nothing short of amazing. And I said it last night when watching this, Stephen King does not like religion. He really doesn't. But it's amazing because it's such at the forefront of so many of his films. But this is the original movie, Carrie, Sissy Spacek, John Travolta, curly blonde haired guy whose name I can never remember, PJ Souls. This movie is nothing short of magic for a horror fan. It's nothing short. And Sissy Spacek is just so, I mean, nothing short of being a beautiful maniac in this movie. And it's so good. I mean, if this is a movie you have not seen, you should stop what you are doing right now and go and watch it. And then come into our Discord, Handle a Scare, and tell us what you thought. Because I'd be curious, because I could debate the glories of this movie till the day I die.
Right on. And definitely one that, the remake was okay, but the third act alone just did not hit the same highs. But either way, definitely go check out Carrie ahead of next week's episode. I bought it digitally for like $5, even though I already own the movie.
It was worth it.
But just to be able to stream it for this.
Yeah.
And well worth it every time. But yeah, that's coming up to wrap up our Farsophobia for this month. And of course, we'll let you guys know what we'll be deep diving into for May during our next recording as well. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, again, just as a reminder, we will be streaming tomorrow night, which is Thursday. Check it out, another new release. I don't know what we're watching as of yet. The problem, Grind, that I've been running into here recently is it seems more and more of the VOD releases are still coming out on Friday. It isn't kind of like alternating between Tuesday and Friday, which it usually happened prior. So I don't know what I'm going to watch yet, but I'll have to come up with something, even if it's a rewatch on my end. But, you know, there's still been some pretty solid entries here, at least within the last week or two that we've seen. So I'm sure we'll come up with something nonetheless. But with that being said, guys, that will do it for us here tonight on Handle with Scare. We will see you guys back, hopefully, for our next watch party. And if not, we'll see you for our Carrie episode. Y'all have a good night.